भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So we are reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 13, and we will be reading text 11, 12, 13, and 14. Karoti kama vashagam. Karmani avijitendriyam. Dukkha darkani samshayam. Rajovega vimohitam. Karoti kama vashagam. Karmani avijitendriyam. Dukkha darkani samshayam. Rajovega vimohitam. Karoti kama vashagam. Karmani avijitendriyam. Dukkha darkani samshayam. Rajovega vimohitam. Karoti. Performs. Kamam. Of material desires. Vacham. Under the control. Gam. Having gun. Karmani. Fruitive activities. Avijitam. Uncontrolled. Indriyam. Whose senses? Dukam. Unhappiness. Udarkani. Bringing as a future result. Sampashyam. Seeing clearly. Raja. Of the mood of passion. Vega. By the force. Vimohitam. Bewildered. So, translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. One who does not control the material senses comes under the control of material desires and is thus bewildered by strong waves of the mood of passion. Such a person executes material activities, although clearly seeing that the result will be future unhappiness. Text 12, we can sing together. Rajas tombayam yadapi vidvam vikshitati puna atangrika manayunjam dosha drishti nasajate. Translation. Although the intelligence of a learned person may be bewildered by the moods of passion and ignorance, he should again carefully bring the mind under control. By clearly seeing the contamination of the moods of nature, he does not become attached. Apramati, let's sing together. Apramati miyunjitam manomai arthayanchane anirvinayata kalam jita shvasa jita samham. A person should be attentive and grave and never lazy or morose. Mastering the yoga procedures of breathing and sitting properly, one should practice fixing the mind on me at dawn, noon, and sunset, and thus gradually the mind should be completely absorbed in me. And one more. Etavan yoga dishtam machishya sanakadibhi sarvato manya krishya mani adavashyatam. The actual yoga system, as taught by me, by my devotees, headed by Sanat Kumara, is simply this. Having withdrawn the mind from all other objects, one should directly and appropriately absorb it in me. Purport. The word yata, accordingly or properly, indicates that like Uddhava, one should hear directly from Lord Krishna or his bona fide representative and directly, adha, fix the mind in Lord Krishna. Karoti kama vashaga karmani avichitendriya dukadarkani sampashyan raja vega vimokitam. One who does not control the mind, material senses, comes under the control of material desires and is thus bewildered by the strong waves of mood of passion. Such a person executes material activities, although clearly seeing that the result will be future unhappiness. Om Jnana Timirandasya Gnanjana Shlakaya Chakshuram. Vanchakalpatrubhyasya Kripa Siddhambhaya Chapatitanam Pavanyadyo Vaishnavedo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram 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 Hare Hare. So Krishna is here telling Uddhava, answering his question. Essentially, Uddhava was saying, my dear Lord, how is it possible that intelligent people can become bewildered by material senses, even though they know what the future result will be? So Krishna is here explaining that for one who does not control material senses, he comes under the control of material desires, and they are so strong, like the ocean waves. They can totally bring anybody under the control. Imagine if you are in the Atlantic Ocean and you're trying to wrestle around with the big waves. The chance of survival is slim, almost nothing. So similarly, for one who does not restrict material senses, the material desires become very, very forceful, and they dictate the action and way of life, and consequently bring one to future miseries. So recently we had a wonderful seminar, and I'm sure many of you were there, but for those of you who were not there, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu was explaining how the anarthas, they actually shape our mental floor. And it's interesting comparison. He was saying, just like the floor could be slanted, and if it's raining, the water will be flowing in certain direction. So similarly, for the person who is under the influence of material desires, the consciousness is actually shaped in such a way that he will respond in a particular way. And how is that so? You may notice, you know, if you see sometime, you know, on the slightest provocation, one person becomes like extremely angry and furious, where the other person may just, you know, totally brush it off and, you know, keep walking, you know, minding his or her own business. So what does make such a huge difference? Why does one person act in one way where the other one is totally peaceful? I remember one particular instance where in a, you know, I would say in a short period of time, maybe 30 minutes, I witnessed like two extremes, and I was totally bewildered. I was thinking like Krishna is really kind of teaching me, you know, how the moods of nature are actually working. So what happens, we were attending a seminar, myself and my family, in Croatia, in one beautiful city near the Adriatic Sea called Split. And Sachinanda Maharaj, he was leading seminar for several days, and we were just, you know, so happy to be there. And typically the schedule was, in the morning we would chant together with Maharaj, there would be class, and then sometime throughout the day, devotees would usually go and swim, because it was summer, and it's, you know, beautiful weather there. And then in the evening, there would be continuation, we would have a seminar, lectures, and so on. So one day, we were driving to the beach, and as we were trying to turn into the parking lot, and being that it's July, you know, there is so many tourists and local people, and the place is totally packed. And usually it's very hard to find parking. So as we were coming in, all of a sudden I heard some loud screaming, and I was, you know, we were looking like totally bewildered. What is going on? Is it like maybe fire, or somebody maybe have a heart attack, or, but, and then all of a sudden I noticed the man, across the street. As I was getting in the parking lot, he was coming out, and we were both waiting on a light. So I noticed him, he was totally out of his mind, screaming and yelling. You would think like, gosh, like, you know, what's happening? Is he going to kill somebody? Like, And he was yelling on his girlfriend, and she was totally, you know, you could see like she totally didn't want to be with him. And so we were just thinking like, wow, like this is like totally out of place. You know, you wouldn't expect, you know, in the middle of the day, somebody to lose so much, lose the temper. And sure enough, we came in, and the place is totally packed. There is no place to park. And probably that's why he flipped out. So you have to kind of park, and then you have to walk. The beach is, you know, probably another 10-15 minutes walk. So we decided, you know, we're going to drive down to the beach. I let my family go. And then I came back, and I was just waiting maybe 5 minutes, and I found parking, no problem. So then I was walking peacefully towards them, and all of a sudden in the distance, I noticed saffron, you know, saffron dress, and then all of a sudden I see Sachinandana Maharaj, and he's you know, peacefully sitting on a rock with two devotees and chanting japa, you know, with his saffron chadar. And if you ever met Sachinandana Maharaj, you know he's like a spiritual magnet. You know, once you see him, you just, you know, you're naturally drawn, you want to be with him. He is so spiritually attractive that that you just spontaneously want to be there and hear what he has to say. So I noticed he was chanting, so I didn't want to disturb him. I just offered my humble obeisance and I continued. But I was just so impressed by such extremes. You know, on one side you see, and it's the same place. You know, it's not like, you know, if he was like 10 miles away. No, it's like pretty much same area. But he was peacefully meditating, chanting, and the other guy, he was like totally mad. So the next morning, Maharaj, he was giving class, and he said, and he mentioned something really intriguing that kind of stuck in my mind, which kind of proves what the consciousness of you know, somebody who is totally transcendental is. So he was saying, and he mentioned that particular beach. He was saying while he was swimming with two other devotees, they noticed a little bumblebee. He was stuck in the ocean waves, you know, a little bumblebee. And, you know, bumblebee, you know, if he's, you know, covered by the ocean waves, he cannot really rescue himself. So one of the disciples, he asked Maharaj, what should we do? You know, they could see that the bee was struggling with the water waves, and, you know, there was really no chance that, you know, he would survive much longer. So Maharaj said, take him out. We can't let him suffer here. And that devotee, he was thinking like, you know, gosh, what if he bites me? Have you ever, any of you got bitten by wasp or bee? I did many times when I was a kid, especially. So you know how painful it is. So that devotee, he was first kind of reluctant, but he thought like, you know, look, if my guru is instructing me to do it, you know, I'm going to do it no matter what. And I must say he was very brave. So he took the bee on his finger and he swam with one hand. He was really good swimmer. So he swam with one hand to the shore, and he let the bee, you know, peacefully walk to the rock, and he saved the bee. So I was just thinking, you know, it stuck in my head for all these years. How is it like, you know, one person, he's so compassionate, he's so conscious of all other creatures that, you know, he doesn't have his own problems, while the other person, he's so absorbed in his own sense enjoyment that even, you know, such silly thing as a parking can totally, you know, get him out of the mental state and to the point of total madness. So that kind of gives us a really graphic example, why is it so important to control the senses in the first place? And if we look a little bit deeper, how does that all take place in our head? You know, normally, especially for us devotees, we know what the consequences are, and we heard so many examples. But still, you know, from time to time, we experience material desires. They creep in, and they try to influence our action. So, Chaitanya Charanprabhu was saying, the process to be applied should be restrict, redirect, and reconstruct. And I like that very much, because first we have to restrict our indulgence in any kind of pleasure. Just imagine, you know, there is a wonderful ice cream, and all of us like ice cream, you know, there is no denial. But, you know, you can take a small cup, or you can eat all gallon. And if you eat all gallon, you're going to definitely have stomach problems, and you're not going to feel good afterwards. But initially, it feels like, feels good. And that's why you keep eating. You know, you keep eating and keep eating. But unless you say, stop, this is enough, your stomach is going to hurt. So similarly, with any type of sense enjoyment, the restriction is in place for a reason. And therefore, we have four regulative principles, and they are called principles of freedom for a reason, because they help us. First of all, if we just follow the four regulative principles, that automatically eliminates so many complications and so many troubles in life that people in general are experiencing. So, I wanted to basically narrate one particular example. Now, to control the senses, Prabhupada, he's mentioning in Bhagavad Gita, I like verse 270, if you remember. That verse talks about how there are so many rivers coming into the ocean, but the ocean remains peaceful. It doesn't become disturbed. So the flow of desires continuously comes in, but the saintly person has to stay calm. And Prabhupada, in that particular purport in that verse, he's saying, as long as we have material body, the material desire for sense enjoyment will be present. So there's no question, like, you know, that, you know, at some point, you know, it's not a question, is it going to be there or not? As long as there's a material body, the desire for sense enjoyment will be present. However, the spiritually minded person does not become bewildered by that. And that is so important. So, as Benjamin Franklin would say, investment in knowledge pays the highest interest. And why is that so? And so much, especially for us devotees, investment in knowledge is so important, because if we know how all the process works, that can help us tremendously to control our mind and senses. So we were talking the desire. Now, the desire itself doesn't just happen, you know, like this. Typically, there are thoughts that come in our mind by the influence of the free moods of nature. And based on those thoughts, the desire will take birth, and then it will force the action later on. So just imagine, I don't know if you ever visited any big city, and you were on a busy train station or a subway or a bus station, whichever. So just imagine there's so many trains or so many buses coming and going. If you were in New York City, you know how busy it is. All these trains and subway system, it's like so busy all the time. So in the same way, our mind is like a train station. The thoughts, they keep coming and going. Some are good, some are bad. So So just like you carefully want to make sure that you go on the proper train. Similarly, we want to be careful to allow only those thoughts that are beneficial to our spiritual progress. And in other words, you don't want to get on a wrong train. And if you do, what would you do? You want to get off as soon as possible. So if a bad thought comes in our head, it's like, you know, it means you definitely went on a wrong train. So you don't want to be sitting and just doing nothing. You know, once you realize, hey, I'm actually on a wrong train, first thing you want to get off. And then the second thing, you want to find out a way how to get back to where you intended to go. So similarly, you know, if the bad thought comes in our head, we have to realize, this is not the train I'm looking for. You know, I'm going to let this train pass. So, you know, just like a bad thought, you know, let it go. It will come and leave, and you wait for the right train or the right thought of Krishna consciousness, something that will inspire you and enthuse you in your spiritual and devotional life. So, in the eighth canto, there is a wonderful story that I like to share with you. Shukadeva Goswami, he explains there's a mountain called the Trikuta Mountain, which is 80,000 miles high. Can you imagine how high that is? It's extremely high. And that same mountain is also 80,000 miles wide. And it's surrounded by the ocean of milk, not by the Atlantic Ocean, not by the Pacific Ocean, but ocean of milk. So that mountain is very, very special, and it's very beautiful. It has three peaks. One is of gold, one is of silver, and one is of iron. And on that mountain, there are beautiful lakes, rivers, caves, and so many amazing, you know, wonderful natural sights. So the demigods, they frequently go there to sport, to visit. Any of you like hiking and mountain climbing? Any mountain climbers? You? Oh, just see. Pradesh, yeah. And Dharma. Is it Dharma? So it's a wonderful place for demigods. They continuously go there and sport, and they go with their families. So on that particular mountain, there is a beautiful garden. It's called, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but Ritunath or something like that. I may not be pronouncing correct. But anyhow, that garden belongs to Varuna. And in that garden, there is a wonderful lake where the demigods and damsels, demigods, they go there and bathe. And it's explained that all the area is so intoxicating by the sight and the beauty of flowers and beautiful birds. And anybody who goes there is totally bewildered by the scenery. So one day, there was a king of elephants. His name is Gajapati Gajendra. He was walking towards the lake. He was thirsty and he wanted to refresh himself. So he was walking with his family and his wives and children. And it's explained that Gajendra, he is the king of the elephants because he's so powerful that the other animals, just by smelling the scent of his body, they would run away. You know, lions, tigers. You know, just by smelling the scent of Gajendra, they would totally, you know, run away, you know, out of respect. They wouldn't want to be on his way. So one day Gajendra was marching towards the lake. He was thirsty and, you know, he wanted to refresh himself. And, you know, he was so heavy that it sounded like all the mountain was trembling. Just by every step he was taking. And on the way, he was crushing all the, you know, little trees, and like he was just, you know, marching towards the lake. So finally, he reached the lake, which was so beautiful. The water was like crystal clear. And he went in, he was enjoying swimming. He was bathing his kids with his tusk. You know, he was, you know, draw the water out of the lake and, you know, sprinkle them. So they were having good time. But all of a sudden, there was a huge, huge crocodile. Not alligator from Gainesville, but crocodile. And this crocodile, he was so large that, you know, once he got a grip of the Gajendra's leg, he just kept holding on to it. And even though Gajendra was so powerful, you know, he tried to shake him off, you know, this way, that way, he couldn't do it. And the crocodile, he was angry because he thought, like, you know, these elephants, they're disturbing my home. So he was just holding like tight grip. And then the other elephants, they came and they tried to assist Gajendra to push him out of the lake, but nobody could do it. So Bhagavatam explains that they fought, that there was a huge battle between them for 1,000 years. Can you imagine that? 1,000 years. The crocodile was battling the elephant and, you know, sucking blood. And as the time was progressing, something interesting happened. First of all, the crocodile, even though he was smaller, because he was in his natural element, which is water, he became stronger. He was getting nourishment by, you know, feeding on elephant's leg. And he was, you know, he was at his home. You know, that's his natural element, water. So he was getting refreshed, energized, and he was getting stronger. Meanwhile, Gajendra, the elephant, because he was out of his natural element, you know, for him, natural element would be on the earth, walking, but not, you know, in a deep water. So during that time, Gajendra was getting weaker and weaker, and he was totally collapsing. So after 1,000 of years, he realized, oh my God, oh my Krishna, you know, there is no hope here. You know, I'm losing this battle, you know, I always won, but this one I'm losing. So Gajendra, all of a sudden, he started remembering. In his previous life, Gajendra was actually a great devotee. He was a king Indradyumna. He was cursed by the sage. He was one day, you know, after retiring from his kingdom, he was simply meditating. And the sage Agastya Muni, he came with his disciples. And the king, because he was in deep meditation, he didn't really offer proper respect. So the sage cursed him. But as a devotee, King Indradyumna, he understood this curse is actually a blessing. So now in this life, as an elephant, all that memory of his devotional practice came back by the mercy of the Lord. He started remembering, and you would think, like, how could an elephant pray, but by the mercy of the Lord, anything is possible. So Gajendra, he started praying, offering beautiful prayers. If you ever read that chapter, there is beautiful prayers. Prabhupada writes wonderful purports, page after page, page after page. I was just looking last night. Amazing. And so he was praying like that. And then all of a sudden, Lord Vishnu, he appears on the scene. On his carrier Garuda. And as Gajendra saw him, he picked the lotus from the lake with his tusk and he offered it. And can you imagine that? You know, it's not like he's in comfortable position. He's in total pain. For 1,000 of years, he's being tortured by this crocodile. But still, he picked the flower, lotus flower, and he offered it to the Lord. So that is the devotion. And that is what all of us are trying to develop in our heart. So the reason I'm mentioning this story, In that particular chapter, there is one verse where Prabhupada wrote a comment, actually, after some of our sannyasis had some troubles. And Prabhupada writes a really amazing comment. And he's saying, in our Krishna consciousness movement, we have declared war against the illusory energy. And therefore, it is so crucial that all of us are properly situated. And he's saying on, he's explaining, therefore, we have different varnas and different ashrams where everybody can find proper place, place in which we will be emotionally, mentally, and physically strong to execute our Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada wanted us to be very, very practical and at the same time find a place where we can be in our natural element. In other words, we don't want to be like Gajendra outside of our natural element. We definitely want to take risks for Krishna and do the best we can. But at the same time, we have to find a place where we can do it, not just for a month, not just for a year, but for the rest of our lives. So with that example, we can kind of meditate. What is the proper natural element for me? And it's going to be different for all of us. You know, what's comfortable situation for one person may not be for the other person. But anybody can find place where they can be spiritually strong and go on serving the Lord year after year. So, in the verses that we read prior to this one, it was also explained the importance of cultivating the mood of goodness, and how do we do that is by associating with things that are already in the mood of goodness. There was example like just by drinking pure water or associating with people who are in the mood of goodness, by reading the scriptures. And all these things are in the mood of goodness, and that will, over the time, diminish our passion and ignorance and help us come to the spiritual platform. So I will stop here. Thank you so much. And if anybody has any comment or question or critic, please don't be shy to speak. If not, oh yes, please.
Could you repeat what chapter or which section the King of Elephants story is from?
Okay, yeah, sure. So that story is in the 8th canto, chapter 2, second chapter. And then actually, if you continue reading, it goes on. You will also find Gajendra's prayers in the following chapter, chapter 3. But 8th canto, chapter 2. Yes, Prabhu.
You see, one of the biggest challenges with the youth or even kids in college is they don't know what they want to do. They don't know their environment. So, if we're sincerely chanting, really praying, Krishna, show me how I can serve, is that enough to, you know, have Krishna show us our varna, or is there other methods that we should be taking up and some of the youth should be really aware of, like, how can I figure this out? It's good to figure it out when we're 14 or 15, so mm-hmm. we start having the direction.
Absolutely. Actually, in the Vedic times, from the early age, even maybe 10 or 12 young children, they would be actually taught in particular direction. They would be trained in particular for particular duties that they would perform later on. And typically, it would be done by the charts astrologically. They would determine what is the inclination of each child. Nowadays, we don't really have expert astrologers that could really give us precise direction. So like you said, chanting and praying, definitely it's one thing to do, but also it's essential to have exposure to different activities. And I think, especially for our younger generation, you know, at the young age, they may not be 100% certain what their inclination is. But if they are exposed to different activities, over the time they will find, oh, actually, this is something I feel more inclined doing than this. You know, if they experience doing farming and they experience doing teaching, or there is so many activities, but it's essential that they have a variety of experiences. And then with the guidance of senior devotees and with their own introspection that will develop over the time, they will certainly come to the right conclusion. But it may not happen immediately, like you said. Sometimes it may take a while. It would be nice if you would all know immediately and, you know, not waste time on things that really are not going to be practical in our life. But in this age, it's a challenge, definitely a challenge. I don't know if anybody else would like to add to that.
You mentioned farming. I saw a stat that something like 90% of the farmers are in their 60s and ready to retire. And we need young farmers.
Absolutely.
So any of you guys wanting to farm, we're not going to have food unless you start taking it up.
Yeah, definitely. That is such a noble activity. It's said that actually it's not encouraged in general society. Farming is now done by machines. There's, you know,
I heard Prabhupada said it's the most noble occupation.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Just being in the nature, working with Mother Earth is so purifying. And I'm sure if any of you met like really serious gardener, you could see that person is in the mood of goodness. Typically, they're very, very pious, even if they're not necessarily devoted, but they're usually very much in the mood of goodness and inclined to spirituality, at least. Just by being in touch with Mother Earth, it's purifying. Okay, well, thank you so much. Karantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.